You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
With me is Michael Power, investment strategist at Investec Asset Management, sometimes based in Cape Town. Michael, I want to talk about China because the trade data that came out just a few days ago shows a slowing economy, I think. And what is your opinion? Is it because of the trade wars that have now been going on for, I suppose, about a year and a half, even longer than that?
No doubt some of the slowing is due to the trade wars. But we also have to mix into the equation the fact that the shape of the Chinese economy is starting to change and that the consumer is becoming a far more important weight in the determination of growth than they've been in the past. I also think we need to look at the makeup of that trade. We're beginning to see, for instance, the Chinese tourist now traveling to an extraordinary degree, so that they're now spending twice as much as the Americans are every year abroad. This is really changing the way in which we can look at the trade account, and especially the current account of China.
Is that so important? The fact that there are so many Chinese tourists now, they're allowed to go out, they have the ability to go out, they have the money to go out, the authorities are allowing them to go out of the country. And you think that that is impacting on domestic consumption?
No, if I said that, I didn't mean it. It's evidence of domestic consumption at an extraordinary scale. And people who look at China as a giant factory are missing half of the point at the moment. In 2001, there was a famous saying in Shenzhen that we make TVs and Americans watch them. Today, the saying is we make TVs and we watch them too. China has become, for many Chinese multinationals, its own best market. And I think that the vision that we have of China, of merely being a place that exports stuff to the rest of the world but doesn't consume itself, is very outdated.
So the evolution of China as a world power has been rapid. I mean, it's been 25 years now, and suddenly it's the second biggest economy in the world, and suddenly what you're saying is that the consumption versus export balance is shifting almost as quickly. I mean, where do you see it in 10 years' time, for example?
Running a current account deficit. I do not see it necessarily being, at least in all areas that it is today, the workshop of the world, not least because the trade war is indeed forcing people to think, gosh, is there a cheaper place in the world where I can make something? Hence the exodus to places like Vietnam, even places like Ethiopia and Kenya. We are now beginning to see people, especially in textiles, shoes, those sorts of spaces, say, I'm not sure that necessarily we need to be based in China. And I think this is changing things. Of course, China has its own plan on top of this, and that is what's broadly called Made in China 2025, where they've identified 10 industries that they hope to dominate the world in, and they're pretty much the 10 leading industries of 2025. It's this, indeed, more than anything else, that's probably upset Donald Trump. I actually think that Donald Trump is misunderstanding the true agenda of China, which is not Made in China 2025. It's designed and made in China 2030. So that actually they don't want to be dependent on the likes of US, of Intel or Qualcomm for the importation of chips. They want to be able to make those chips themselves.
Who has the upper hand in the so-called trade wars between the United States and China? It seems to me that it's been going on for a long time, and it also seems to me that there's a lot of bluster from the White House, and particularly from the man at the head of the White House, so-called Donald Trump. Do you think he's losing the battle, winning the battle? Is he holding out? What is your interpretation of what might happen?
Well, if we believe the man in the White House, which of course we all do, short term, the United States is probably winning. The irony, of course, is that long-term China will win, and it will win more bigly, to use a wonderful word that Donald Trump sometimes uses. It will win more bigly simply because the process by which China becomes independent of the American technology supply chain is going to be hastened as a result of this trade war.
Speaking of China, and on a side issue, Hong Kong, this is a really big test for the Beijing authorities, the Beijing regime, if you like. What's going to happen there? Because it's starting to become, it started out as an extradition bill protest, and now it's spread for people wanting more of an autonomy for Hong Kong and less authoritarian rule from the Chinese mainland. What do you think of Hong Kong?
I think that's one interpretation. I actually think that it symbolizes another split that's beginning to emerge in Asia, and that's a generational split, quite literally, between the young and the old. And in Hong Kong, we see it very clearly. The young are on the streets and, by and large, extraordinarily well-behaved, by and large, extraordinarily well-voiced, and the old are sitting there trying to defend the status quo and the privilege that goes with it. And, you know, they're having a bit of a tough time of it. I think that the Chinese, looking forward, probably face the greatest battle 10 years down the line, not between the United States and China, not between democracy and whatever China's got, but rather between China's young people and China's old people.
Generational issue we've got here. Now let's move from Hong Kong and China to a jurisdiction, a geography that used to be inextricably linked with Hong Kong, and that's the United Kingdom. And you sent me a piece today, and it says the following, and I have to take you to task on this one. It says, I am in favour of the UK leaving the EU. That's the first thing, that's the headline, but then you go on to qualify that. But not for the reasons you typically hear from the Brexiteers, a group who are, for the most part, you say, singularly incapable of formulating a clear argument. Hello? That's, you know, sort of Sky News every day or CNN, and I would certainly back you up on that one. To borrow a phrase you go on to say from T.S. Eliot, it seems as if most leavers are advocating doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. I'm confused about Brexit, and I'm confused about the future of the country of my birth. Again, I need your take on this one.
The real reason why the UK needs to get out of Europe is descending into a quagmire, a financial quagmire. The black hole of its sovereign debt market is but the probably most visible evidence of this. But there are four horses of the apocalypse descending upon Europe at the moment, and they're not really doing very much to deal with them. The first is demographics. A good close to half of the countries in Europe now have got outright population falls, pretty much everything in the east and most of the countries in the south, falling populations. The second thing is productivity growth has slowed to virtually nothing, and it is the combination of productivity and demographics that gives you economic growth. Essentially, it's how many hours we work and how well we work those hours. And they are basically going negative in both instances. The third and fourth are two Latin phrases, which I'm sure you know of, Deus ex machina and Deus ex China, the God in the machine and the God in China. From within, Europe is facing automation, and from without, it's facing competition coming out of Asia that is going to crush, for instance, the German car market. So we are seeing huge amounts of pressure building in Europe, which is going to create major problems. Now, when I say Britain should get out, that doesn't mean that Britain's off the hook here. It's got some very serious problems that it needs to face down itself. But I'll give you one statistic that I still cannot get out of my mind, and that is that the formalized savings base of the United Kingdom, in size, in aggregate, is equivalent to that of the rest of the EU 27 put together. And just to make you feel a little better, 56% of the EU 27 is Dutch. So you basically have unfunded pension liabilities all across the balance sheets of the major countries of Europe, the Netherlands honorably excepted, Sweden, Denmark also reasonably good. But that tragedy of the fact that they haven't actually saved for their aging populations, who are getting ever larger and larger as a proportion of the whole, means Europe is descending into a really bad space. And the UK needs to put more than just the clear water of the English Channel between itself and the continent.
That's a good argument. I wish Boris Johnson was listening to us. Hey, maybe he will be later on. Who knows? But I was going to ask you about Boris Johnson, but I'll get too animated if I do so. What you're saying is that Europe is, you mentioned the word quagmire. Europe is essentially what we consider Europe, not the eastern side of Europe, but the France and the Germanys and the Britons and the Spains and Portugal. It's an old age home. It's becoming an old age home with some pretty buildings here and there.
Museum. Absolutely, an old age home with a museum. I mean, you can actually go and buy whole villages in Italy now for €1, as you may know. And I think that is an absolute tragedy in the making. I think that the bureaucrats of Brussels and their counterparts in the ECB are fiddling while the very nobly intentioned Treaty of Rome is burning. and they aren't facing up to the really serious issues that are bearing down, not just weighing down, but they're bearing down on Europe at the moment. They need to get to grip with the reality of what is dawning, and I don't think they are.
Are we in the latter stages of a very, very mature, long-in-the-tooth bull market in developed world equities? And when I say developed world, let's talk about the United States specifically. It just keeps going on and on. And like a volcano that occasionally erupts and then threatens to become a full-blown eruption, but then it calms down again. We've had two or three of these mini-eruptions. Do you think there's going to be an eruption at some stage? When are we going to get 10, 15%, 20% down? Or is it not going to happen? Is it different this time?
Well, you know that I'm not going to say it's different this time. I think that there are two things that are keeping the US aloft at the moment. Firstly, the consumer, as a result of a reasonably tight labor market, and for as long as that continues to be intact, though I have to say there were two data points out last week that suggest there may be cracks in both. That will keep the economy reasonably going. Consumption is 72% of the United States economy. And the second thing has been, of course, since 2010-11, 100% of all net purchases into the US stock market have come from share buybacks, 25% of which have been financed by debt. So if it was home equity withdrawal that brought down everything in 2007-2008, it is my great fear that it will be corporate equity withdrawal that will do the same in the next couple of years or so.
Finally, of course, we have to speak about South Africa. Here we are sitting in Cape Town. The weather's starting to pick up. There is a few tourists around. I see them all at the waterfront. But I saw lots of people at the waterfront over the weekend. And there was, yeah, a lot of people. But when I looked in the shops, there was nobody in the shops. Everyone was window shopping. What do you think about the future of South Africa politically and economically? I know it's a very, very broad question, but you have to comment upon it for the last couple of minutes, if you would, Michael.
I think we need to catch a wake-up here. The country has been run for 20, 25 years for the benefit of the privileged elite. The reality is that the vast majority of South Africans have not benefited too much from the last 25 years. There is now 35% unemployment, 18 million people directly or indirectly on grants, and no GDP growth. The prospects of getting jobs are pretty thin at the moment, and there don't seem to be very many good ideas out there as to what needs to be done to break this logjam. My favorite statistic, which you might think is totally left field, that really shows up South Africa at the moment, is the fact that Ethiopia created 1.4 million jobs last year. Eat your heart out, South Africa. Exactly. I see the surprise on your face. But the reality is that Kenya and Ethiopia are throwing their lot in with the pan-Asian economy, Indian Ocean as well, and starting to play their part in the value-added game, be it making of shoes, textiles. In Kenya, there's a lot of metal bashing that goes on, and it's pretty small-scale stuff at the moment, but it's really starting to make a difference. And until South Africa can somehow affix itself to the value-added chain of the world today with its surplus labor, we're probably not going to go anywhere particularly fast.
Thanks so much for your insights. And yes, my eyes did widen when you said Ethiopia created 1.4 million jobs last year. That is an astonishing statistic. Michael Power is an investment strategist at Investec Asset Management based in Cape Town. That podcast was proudly brought to you in association with sharenet.co.za. Visit strictlybusinesspodcast.com and subscribe to receive exclusive content straight to your inbox.